The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. City are top. Their undramatic, untelevised win at Everton means they go above Liverpool on goal difference after the Reds were lucky to get a point at West Ham on Monday. Bubbles bursting all over the place. In the FA Cup, Newport County win a tie that had everything apart from an opposition as they beat Middlesbrough. In Scotland, shock as Alfredo Morelos is sent off for only the fourth time this season. In serious football news, we'll chat to Craig Foster about the Save Hakim campaign and debate whether the saviour of football, Gianni Infantino, will manage to get re-elected against, well, no opposition again. We'll look ahead to this weekend's games, take your questions and hopefully have a nice time on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel today. Good morning, Philippe Auclair.
Good morning, Maxime Rushton.
Your scribbling thing is a shopping list or is this notes for the pod?
It's notes about Gianni Infantino.
I see. You could
it's all the stuff I won't have the time to say.
Okay. That's the stuff you're legally not allowed to say, but you'll
correct.
Just show us anyway. Reshmin Chowdhury, good morning.
Good morning.
Sitting in Barry's chair.
I know. What big shoes to fill. What a big seat to fill.
I know. How many cigarettes have you had this morning?
We don't talk about things like that.
Oh, really? Okay. Barry, I was going to say. Well, you didn't come
less
in with a,
Barry.
Smoking a pipe this morning.
But I don't have the Carabao Cup box.
Well, that's okay, you know.
Is that all right?
Look, if you keep performing at this level, maybe one day you'll get your own Carabao box. Lord Keir has a question. With Andy Brassel having found pod opportunities limited of late, should he push for a move elsewhere? Andy, are you happy to stay at the club?
Well, it's a bit late on February the 7th, isn't it? I suppose it is the NBA trade deadline tonight, so I'm hoping to rock up at the Phoenix Suns.
Were you pushing for a move? Were you caught outside the Ramble car park on a deadline day?
I think our listeners will be able to tell you that.
Okay, we'll find out.
Isn't there still a chance for Andy to join the Chinese Super League?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
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 You think so?
Fulfill my sporting ambitions.
Yeah.
I think you
well,
do.
You're a free agent anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you go.
Well, should we start then? We'll start with Monday's game because it was more exciting than yesterday's. West Ham 1, Liverpool 1. Philippe, how bad were Liverpool or how good were West Ham?
Pretty poor, Liverpool. Confirmation of what we've seen in the last few weeks that there seems to be the seed of doubt has been sown and we can see the first green shoots or brown shoots. In that particular team, and they didn't look confident at all. One thing that struck me is the number of times I saw Virgil van Dijk desperately, frantically pointing at various parts of the pitch where his teammates were supposed to be and were not. So for all the talk that, no, we're not getting nervous, everything is hunky-dory, we have our sights on the big one, blah, 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 it's pretty obvious that there is a bit of people are fretting, basically.
You know the thing with Van Dijk, though, and shouting frantically at his teammates? You have to do that if you're one of the leading centre-backs in the world. Look at Kalidou Koulibaly at Napoli. I don't know how he has the lungs to run after the amount of time he spends shouting at his teammates and pushing them physically into position and all that sort of stuff. We're always talking about how few really great central defenders there are.
But with all the injuries that they have, imagine if Virgil van Dijk got injured as well. He is the one holding it all together at the moment.
But is he? Because didn't he make a mistake in the... Who did they draw against? Leicester. I mean, he was at fault for that goal.
He's not beyond...
Because we all think he's the greatest footballer in the world.
Course.
He's still part of that team that didn't play very well.
No, absolutely. But he is still crucial to that back line because of the injuries that Liverpool have all over the park, but particularly defensively.
Lots of people have said... I think Chris Sutton, one describing letting Nathaniel Klein go as Klopp's biggest mistake so far as Liverpool manager.
It's very strange, isn't it? Because they started the season probably with the best collection of right-backs, Joe Gomez, Alexander-Arnold and Nathaniel Klein of any club in the league. And you might have said maybe in Europe. And here they are now having to play James Milner, who is an admirable player, but most definitely of all the positions he's been on the field.
Well, they've played Henderson there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, recently. They have. They've swapped them both over, haven't they?
So, I mean, set pieces as well I thought was interesting. I thought West Ham really had a run on Liverpool there. And
learnt it off Wimbledon a couple of weeks ago. That's what it was.
Do you think it was? Yeah. Did Wimbledon do the little pass and then the cross? Because I know Anderson's delivery was brilliant all night, but... For some reason, that just completely shook Liverpool to their core. And you can see now every team watching that and thinking, well, we can try this, Andy.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, we've been there with Liverpool on Manchester City beforehand. I think still there's no need to panic for Liverpool. If you tell them at the start of the season that they're in this position, I think they snap your hand off.
Game in hand, obviously.
They've still got the game in hand. They've still got an exceptional squad, which is much better than it was last season, even despite the injuries. And, you know, I think their big challenge this season was not to be, and everyone else's challenge really, because I suppose you could say Tottenham are still in it, yes, not to be out of the title race by the time it's Christmas.
But
and we're in February with the other side of the transfer window, and they're well in it.
But they had a big lead, Philly.
They did,
and they missed an opportunity. They missed a couple of opportunities. But again, I think we'll come back to that defeat against Manchester City as being perhaps one of the
millimeters of that ball.
Yeah, I mean, so many other things. The fact that perhaps Manchester City should have been, you know, 10-11 for a large part of the game. And the other thing as well is how things conspire to you when conspire in your advantage. At the beginning, I would have thought that for Manchester City to be in the final of the League Cup would actually be a disadvantage. I mean, an extra game to play, the semi-finals and so forth. And in the end, it's working to their advantage because the game was moved. And because of that, they find themselves ahead. And now it is Liverpool who've got to play catch-up for a few weeks.
They're also playing two extra games than over this month. They're playing two more games than both Liverpool and Tottenham as well, which could or could not work in their favour. But at the end of the day, they still have a chance to win a cup. And that could also galvanise the team into, you know, keeping that momentum and going forward. I think the title race is just utterly compelling at the moment. And it's so much better than last season where City were running away with it. This is so much more exciting, not for Liverpool fans necessarily, for their heart rates or whatever. But it is important, I think, for a league as good as the Premier League and as competitive as the Premier League to stay competitive right towards the very end. And it does seem like it will go that way. In terms of whether nerves are kicking in, I think you're right that they don't need to panic. But I also think with Liverpool that they have got themselves into this situation now where, of course, it's possible given, you know, the season is so long and they can lose points anywhere. But I would be a little bit worried if I was them. And I think now it's all about managing your nerves and managing every game as it comes, because City have been there. City know how to do that. They've got a quality squad of players who know how to win ugly, which Liverpool have started to do, but they know that when it comes to the crunch, they can pull it out the bag when they need to. And I think Liverpool are learning that.
I think we should say a word about Everton as well. Well, for me, the biggest disappointment of the season.
Mm. Well, we'll get to Everton in just a minute. Yes. I'd like to praise West Ham while we're on this game, if that's
okay.
All right.
Yeah, because, no, absolutely.
Because I thought, I mean, considering how bad they were at Wolves, right? I mean, they didn't have they wouldn't make the highlights.
Mm. And the Arnautovic injury as well.
The Arnautovic injury, I thought Noble was brilliant. I thought Snodgrass was brilliant. Anderson, Declan Rice, who has had a lot of plaudits, but I probably haven't spent enough time watching him. Yes. Didn't lose the ball, always in the right place. I was so impressed with him.
They're a funny side, aren't they? They can just turn it on when they need to, and then when they can't be bought, like against Wimbledon.
But what they're achieving, the way they're playing, the results they're getting, most of the results they're getting, when you think of the number of injuries they've got to absolutely, vital, components of the team. I mean, we've forgotten about Yarmolenko, who was genuinely one of their great satisfactions at the beginning of the season. We've forgotten about Manuel Lanzini, who is a superb player as well.
Yeah.
But they seem to have players who have popped up and actually delivered for them, and which is all to credit of Mr. Pellegrini.
Okay. You imagine Declan Rice will be in the next England squad. You know, Gareth Southgate needs to nail that down.
Is it all decided now that he's going to play for England?
Well, I don't know if it's totally decided, but he's certainly chosen not to be in the Ireland squad a lot of times.
There's still a lot of Ireland fans begging him on social media. And I can understand that because, you know, the way he's played this season, I think you can make the case that for Ireland, he's a genuinely transformative player. You know, he changes the way what they can look towards, what they can aspire towards over the next 5 to 10 years.
We should mention the officials as well. Imagine if Origi had scored that chance at the end and Liverpool had won 2-1 with two offside goals. I mean, I just can't imagine the conspiracy theorists. It would have gone totally. It would have just been ridiculous.
Although
wouldn't it?
Online ruler manufacturers would have been doing a roaring trade.
Look, Milner was miles offside. I don't think, do we need to say any more than that? It was a poor bit of officiating. It's very hard for the assistant referee. He's got to look at Lallana's feet to make sure the ball's not out.
Correct.
He's in the wrong place, but you can't look in more than one place at one time.
It's very easy for us to say, never mind VAR, if officials can't get that right, they shouldn't be doing it. But on the other hand, the offside rule has become so ridiculously convoluted and I think drifted away from the original point. It's a point that Rory Smith made recently. It's just drifted away from the spirit of the law. Like personally, in countries where you do have VAR, I don't care if someone's 3 centimetres offside.
No.
It's totally contrary to the spirit of the rule. And I know a lot of people listening will disagree with that. But
you know, when they're just...
I think more will agree with you, actually. Mm. It is ridiculous that people are trying to dissect a super slow-mo showing that the fifth metatarsal was slightly offside. Yeah. Was offside, not slightly offside. You're either offside or you're not.
Exactly. That's what Lars would tell you. Sean says, is Klopp heading for a Keegan-style I'd love it moment? I mean, I'd love it personally.
Is it going full Rafa? You have to ask at this point in the season, don't you? Especially with Liverpool.
So to go full Rafa, what is that? Is that you prepare your notes and you have 15 minutes where you explain that you're the best team in the land anyway? Or
yeah, I suppose the question is that now Mourinho? Is that going Jose? Because he's a...
That's really harsh on him.
Formidable note user in press conferences, isn't he? And I'm sure Rafa and Jose would love to be compared to each other.
Anyway, look, it was a fascinating game on the pitch. Some unsavoury chanting off the pitch. Jacob Steinberg was there and he can update us on what happened and what the club are doing about it. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Jacob, just explain what happened.
Well, it's something that appeared to occur during the first half of the game when Mohamed Salah was taking a corner for Liverpool in front of a section that was housing home fans. And it's the video captures a fan, someone in the crowd, appearing to aim Islamophobic abuse at Mohamed Salah. And obviously it's gone viral on Twitter yesterday, and the club are looking to try and find out where that was coming from. They're looking at their own CCTV footage, because in the video itself you can't see who's doing the shouting, and so they're going to have to look through their own footage to see that, and they're quite confident that they'll be able to, that they've got the ability to do that, and the police are looking as well. So if it's possible to do that, then if it's possible to identify the person and they're found to have done it, then I think they'd be looking at a lifelong ban from West Ham.
What's the reaction been on social media to your reporting? I mean, we've all sort of seen you engaging with a lot of people who are, you know, accusing you of doing all sorts of things to try and destabilise West Ham when you appear to just be reporting racist abuse. It's strange.
It is strange. It's not entirely surprising. At the same time, I should point out that there are a lot of people who've been extremely supportive, and I think, to be honest, that the overwhelming majority are, and I know far too many West Ham fans who I consider friends, who are my friends, who to know that it's not a problem that affects every single West Ham supporter, and that most West Ham fans, I can say with confidence, aren't like that. But at the same time, there are a lot who appear to be holding quite troubling views. And you know, Friday, we reported on a member of West Ham's official supporters board resigning from the board because there were anti-Semitic, homophobic, and racist photos on his website. And we simply reported the fact that he had resigned. We didn't do anything to make him resign. It was actually found that the photos were there a few weeks ago, and he actually announced the resignation himself last week, which is how we found out about it. So we haven't really sat there and done anything to do that. There's been no sort of great journalistic investigating going into doing that. At the same time, it wasn't particularly hard to find the photos because they were there in plain sight. So you kind of have to question how he was allowed onto the board, how no one at West Ham thought to maybe check that kind of stuff out to see, because it takes about 2 seconds to find those photos. From there, on Sunday, a prominent West Ham fan YouTube channel, so not affiliated to the club, I should point out, an independent channel, suddenly got onto me on Twitter, calling me a blood-sucking leech, which it's always nice to be specific, because I'm not sure what other kind of leeches there are. And claiming it was banter, which is the catch-all phrase for this kind of stuff, yeah. That it's just banter. And then that's one of the things as well that is some people kind of suggested it is with the Mohamed Salah abuse as well. You know, they sort of said, well, what would be the issue if I called Roberto Firmino a Brazilian so-and-so, you know, that kind of argument. And it's not banter. It's vile. It's unacceptable. One of the, to give you a flavour of it, one of the photos portrayed, it showed a large gathering of Orthodox Jews with the caption, Scheidt Lane will be full this season because of half price season discounts, half price season ticket discounts, something along those lines. Now, the banter there, obviously kind of suggesting to me that Jews are cheap and stingy, you know, give them a half price offer and those Spurs fans will be running up to White Hart Lane to take advantage. Now, you might think that's banter, but it kind of just reinforces stereotypes around race, you know, racist stereotypes around what Jews are like. There's obviously a rivalry between West Ham and Tottenham fans, which I don't have a problem with. There's nothing problematic about there being a healthy sporting rivalry between two sets of fans. But it's when you start to associate a religious group being affiliated to that club. And obviously, Spurs do have a lot of Jewish supporters. You know, they are traditionally seen as a Jewish club. But it's when you start to use that against them, when that's used as something to beat Tottenham fans with, to start to use connotations around Jews and aim those kind of slurs at them, that you start to normalise that language. And that's what leads to when it's West Ham v Spurs, or it happens in Chelsea Spurs games as well, where you start to hear chants around the Holocaust. You know, the famous chant is Spurs are on their way to Auschwitz, Hitler's going to gas them again. You hear hissing noises in the echo of the gas chambers. There are chants around foreskins, and obviously none of that is acceptable. And none of that falls under the category of banter. It's just racist. It's just anti-Semitic.
Jacob, do you think that West Ham are doing enough?
Well, I think with the Salah case, it's being dealt with. It's being dealt with extremely quickly. I think that when it comes to the guy who's resigned from the board, they actually, as far as I'm aware, they dealt with it very quickly. And the guy was resigned as soon as Kicker Out had pointed it out to the club. So I don't think you can say that they don't treat these things seriously. I would point out that West Ham, one of their owners, David Gold, is Jewish. I know that it affects him. Obviously, that doesn't necessarily mean that it gives them any kind of extra importance that he's Jewish. Any owner should be appalled by it. But I do know that it's something that affects him, and that he would much prefer it not to happen. I know that within the club itself, that they are trying to get to sort out the issues that do flare up at times. They don't. It's not like they just put their finger in their ears. And on this kind of subject, they are looking to get rid of this guy who was aiming the abuse at Salah. But it's just not easy to change that. And you'd have to say as well that with all the kind of stuff that's been flaring up in English football over the last season, it seems to be a rising problem. You know, you've had the issues at Chelsea, you've had the problems with Spurs, the FA looking into the chanting at the Millwall v Everton game last month, and it's not that people suddenly turn up at a football match and are suddenly racist. It's a problem within society itself. You know, it just reflects what's going on, some of the attitudes that we're seeing there as well.
Jacob, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Jacob Steinberg there, reporting on the problems off the pitch at West Ham. Back on to the football last night. Manchester City won at Everton 2-0. Pretty sort of straightforward victory. Do you think Everton fans wanted City to win? I mean, I really think some of them would. I was doing a radio show yesterday, and they were phoning up saying, I want to lose 8-0 today because I can't cope with Liverpool winning the title.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of that as well. I mean, I'm sure there's part of them that would have wanted that result or a result for Manchester City. But, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? But I suppose as football fans, we can be a bit fickle sometimes, and I suppose you end up supporting your enemies if you need to. But
I suppose the other question is, does it quicken the end for Marco Silva? Or would there be fans behind that? Because I think we've all been in that situation before, haven't we, as football fans? Well, it'd be nice to be a win at the weekend, but will that prolong the tenure of our lame duck of a manager?
Possibly.
Fix things in the medium to long term?
Do you say to Everton fans, do you want to win? And they say, well, do we have a choice? It's not really up to us, is it? And once again, from set pieces.
It's appalling. What do they do in training?
You've got the numbers. I mean, they are astonishing, really.
At Hull City, right, when Marco Silva was in charge, they shipped 11 goals. That was the worst record in the Premier League that season. At Watford, they conceded 12 from set pieces, the third worst in the division. At Everton, his team's record, 14, according to Opta, 19 if you add in the cup competitions as well.
Yeah. I mean, I was at the Millwall game, and I couldn't believe it. When that third goal when Millwall got the winner, I remember that because it was, a minute after Everton's equalised, and you're thinking, how did you just give away a free kick there of all play? I mean, it was just a complete lack of concentration, a complete lack of confidence as well. But they do not know what to do from a set piece, wherever it's coming from.
And this is Wilson was trying to coach me on zonal marking on Monday. Andy, you can have another go if you want. I mean, I don't want to be a proper football man, but everyone get a man and don't let him go. And it works.
I'm all for man-to-man at set pieces. Absolutely. Yeah. But the thing is, whether it's man-to-man or zonal, if you don't take responsibility, if you don't attack the ball, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever which
you've
of those two systems
you
use.
You've got to see the action of the ball and where it's going,
and you've got
to commit. Exactly.
Exactly. I mean, the thing that amazed me about that Millwall equaliser, which was obviously highly controversial in that cup game, how could you dare to commit a handball like that in so much space? I mean... Yeah, I can't believe they got away with it still.
Yeah, so more from set pieces.
He said it sort of came off his arm.
Okay.
as they do.
It's conceded more from set pieces, including penalties in all competitions this season, than any other Premier League side. Six of their past eight goals conceded have been from set pieces. I mean, Marco Silva's got a plan, right? And if you go from Martinez to Koeman to Allardyce to Silva in such a short space of time, it's going to be hard, right? It's going to be difficult for the players to listen to different things. But defending free kicks, you know... It must be hard for Everton fans to go, actually, we would have conceded fewer if Allardyce was still there.
It must give Sam Allardyce a lovely warm feeling inside, though.
Oh, I'm right? sure.
I've just made a little calculation with the help of my little device here. The number of points that Everton would finish the season with if they carried on at the current tempo, 48.
Right.
How many points did they get under Sam Allardyce in the Koeman truncated season? 49.
£350 million as well. Spent and it is hard to break into the top six, but Moshiri's given Silva a vote of confidence.
He's given him his backing, hasn't he? And they say it's a long-term project.
What does that mean?
Well, exactly. They say it's a long-term project and bringing in the youth to complement the money they spent on the experience as well. But
and also, I mean, neither Richarlison nor Sigurdsson were on the field. Certainly at starters, they came on later on the pitch. I mean, these are the two guys who scored more goals than anybody else in that particular side.
And £90 million.
Yes, so obviously not everything is great. And you wonder because it's been a bit the same at Watford, actually, with Marco Silva. There was a great start to the season and then things started to, get a little bit jerky and actually then the wheels came off. I mean, some people said it was because of the interest of Everton and the fact that it had distracted the dressing room as well as the manager. Well, you actually, with hindsight, you're looking back thinking, can we see a bit of a pattern happening here?
Go on.
I was just going to say, we're working off very small sample sizes with Marco Silva because he spent such short periods.
He only does small sample sizes, doesn't he?
Well, that could be a whole other conversation. But
yes, listen, Reshman, if you want to, I know you're in Barry's chair, but you don't need to bring the tone down, all right? So look, Liverpool, City are above Liverpool, a goal difference, plus 48, Liverpool plus 41, Liverpool have a game in hand. Who are the favourites?
Tottenham? No, sorry. Well, actually, don't discard Tottenham.
I'm not.
Because I'm also looking at what's going to happen in February and until March. They got Leicester at home.
But they have away trips to Liverpool,
They've got away trips to Burnley.
And City.
Burnley, Chelsea, and then they have Arsenal at home. Yeah, we're talking about the next four rounds, so to speak. And you can imagine that this could be quite a good time for them.
Spurs like this season's Leicester, do we think? I mean, it's funny, isn't it, how they've found a way to dig in.
And to still be in it.
Games, yeah.
You mentioned the Everton-Millwall game. Obviously, there was some racist chanting at that one as well. The chief executive of Millwall, Steve Kavanagh, saying, look, we've got together to put a raft of measures in place to make sure we try and rid this club of any of these tags. We've shut the top section of block 17, 18 and 19. We put extra stewarding in that area, which will stay until the end of the season. Police spotters will be up there to make this area as controlled. Myself and a number of board members went into the stand in Block 18, spoke to the fans over there, made our feelings clear about what went on. Fans also made their feelings clear and they were in line with us. So they get a lot of criticism, Millwall.
But
he's saying all the right things and doing the right things. We've sort of said, what do you do about that? Do you, for a club themselves to close part of their ground, I think is very impressive, actually.
Yes.
And Millwall have taken really drastic measures before, haven't they? I mean, you think of that playoff against Birmingham where there was the violence afterwards. That must be about 13, 14 years ago now. And the attendance is almost halved overnight when they made it a lot more difficult to get a ticket. You had to bring two proofs of address and all that sort of stuff. I know from personal experience what an incredible amount Millwall do in the community. So it's something that I think is very frustrating to a lot of people at the club. But the thing is,
doesn't it tell you that it's a bigger problem than just the club putting in these measures? Because at the end of the day, someone can turn up with a couple of pieces of identity and say, "Oh, this is, you know, this is where I live. I'm entitled to a ticket." But you can't change someone's viewpoints and someone's, you know, what people have casted off as banter for years. That becomes entrenched. And there was the video on social media, wasn't there, after that Millwall game as well, of a young boy chanting awful racist abuse. Yeah. 4 or 5 year old boy copying his parents. So those are things that, I mean, this is bigger than the pod. I mean, this is a whole other pod altogether. But those are issues that need to be tackled on their own before. And the football club can do what they can do. They've got to be seen to be acting, as you say, Max.
But be seen, but actually acting as well. Which
yes,
is, you know,
of course. No, and they are. Yeah. And they should be commended for it because they are doing it. But of course, that's not where the problem lies. The problem is much deeper than that.
Yeah, sure, it is societal, but on the other hand, I think it's interesting that I think there are a lot of people out there who maybe aren't intrinsically racist, but just think that anything's okay when it's in the stadium and you're trying to put off the opposition, which is clearly not the case. But I think that's something that has to be addressed as well. And it's interesting, like Philippe will know, in France, they did this big advertising campaign just in the street where they had people like going into the butcher's shop and like shouting something at the person behind the counter or shouting something at someone at a bus stop and saying, you wouldn't behave like this in normal life, so why would you behave like this inside a stadium?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I thought that was quite interesting and quite effective because it was saying, you know, people talk about football and going to football as a release. It doesn't mean you should forget all of the principles that bind together your daily life. And I think some people do.
I agree with you, Andy. Anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two with El Clasico from last night. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly on the 15th of March in Earth, which is vague, but in Hackney. It's a place in Hackney. It's too cool for us. We've half filled it already, though. Me, Barry, announcing Greg Bukowski for his live show debut, which is exciting. And one more. Who is confirmed, Jonathan? The fourth guest is confirmed. Jonathan won't tell me who it is, but apparently says I'll lose my mind when I find out who it is. So I asked if it was either David Attenborough, Angela Lansbury, or Dr. Carl from Neighbours.
I know the Far Side are playing at Earth in the near future, so I'm going to bet on Fat Lib or Slim Kid Trey.
Okay. I mean, they were all words, but it seemed unconnected to me, Andy. Anyway, come along, please. We'll announce next Thursday who's coming on. In El Clasico, in the Copa del Rey, Barca 1, Real Madrid 1. Was this a good game, Andy?
Yeah, it was good enough. I mean, the shadow over it was since Leo Messi pulled up in the draw with Valencia at the Camp Nou at the weekend and gingerly held the back of his leg. There's been much debate over whether Messi should have actually played this game. I think with this being the first of three Clásicos coming up in the next month, then playing in the Champions League, even though they've got 6 point in lead in La Liga, that the sense was no, he shouldn't. And he came on as substitute in the second half. And I'm not really sure what purpose it served, to be perfectly honest. His de facto replacement, Malcolm, did a pretty good job. Messi looked like he wasn't really sure whether he should be there or not, which is quite unusual for him because, of course, he's someone who doesn't like to miss any football. But, yeah, he didn't seem to really want to commit to it. Like he wasn't sure whether it was a great idea himself, and he didn't really do anything to change the course of the game. And how often can we say that about Leo Messi?
How is the Copa del Rey viewed? I mean, are there phone-ins in Spain all the time going, has the Magico gone?
Well, I guess it's like every other cup competition, isn't it? In the sense that in major footballing countries, in that the same team wins it every year. Like Barcelona have won it the last 4 years, just like Juventus have won the Coppa Italia for the last 4 years, and Paris Saint-Germain have won the Coupe de France the last 4 years. So I think it tells us quite a lot about European football. I think when you go back to the earlier rounds, the fact that games are two-legged does really put the block on shocks in the way that it doesn't in the Coupe de France, for example. By this end, it's heated up a little bit. Unfortunately, this year, we usually have an incredibly entertaining stroke, very boring, depending on your view, dispute on where the game's going to be played. Because obviously if Barcelona and Real Madrid are in the last four, that means it puts a question mark. You can't really have it at the Bernabeu or at the Camp Nou. It's going to be at the Betis Stadium, the Benito Villamarín, this season, which is pretty good, which is a fantastic football arena. So that's good to know already. But yeah, it is important. And obviously, every time there's Barcelona versus Real Madrid, it's important. Obviously, the slight bit of the intensity is taken away by the fact that the two legs are a couple of weeks apart. It's not quite the same as in the Taça de Portugal, where you had Benfica versus Sporting in the first leg and won the semi-finals. Now, Portugal, you've got the top four playing against each other. You've got Benfica versus Sporting. It was 2-1 to Benfica in the first leg, which was last night. Porto are playing Braga in the other one, which is coming up in a week and a half. But then there's this huge gap, and they don't play the second leg until April. So basically, you play the first leg. It should be a match of high intensity. It's a match of reasonably high intensity.
You forget about it.
Sporting and Benfica played each other at the weekend. But then it turns up and you're like, oh yeah, we've still got to play that second leg of the cup.
That's quite nice. Gareth Bale and Solari aren't necessarily the best of friends. Solari said this might be Gareth Bale's last chance yesterday. Did he take it? Will he still be there? Will Solari still be there? So many questions.
It didn't make a massive impact when he came on. I think what's interesting is the fact that Vinicius Junior started the game and was always going to start the game instead of Gareth Bale. And given that, from my perspective, it seems like the reason they spent so much on bringing Vinicius Junior over, and it was a complete punt because they spent, 40 million euros on someone who was 16 years old, which is a huge risk in anyone's language. Yeah. The fact that he's managed to come into the first team so quickly and just play his own game and play like he feels he belongs immediately, it's extraordinary, really. Mm. And again, it was his first Clásico, and he was Real Madrid's best player for the time he was on the pitch.
About Gareth Bale, I mean, he and Zidane weren't the best of friends either. No. Apparently, they didn't even speak after he scored that amazing goal in the Champions League final. They didn't speak, and then Zidane left, and that was that.
You'd have thought Zizou would say, good hit, lad. You know, well done, son.
Bit like mine.
Yeah. Well, what he actually said is, that wasn't as good as my Champions League final.
Exactly. Not as good as Leverkusen.
In any way, somebody will have to make way for Eden Hazard in the summer. So when who is it going to be? It's not going to be Karim Benzema. I don't think it's going to be Vinicius.
No, not on the back of his new boxing regime.
Yeah, well, he looks really, I mean, as fit as he's ever looked.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So you're saying that Eden Hazard saying, I've made my decision. You are translating that. You're not saying that's a new 5-year contract at Stamford Bridge.
I don't think so. No,
I don't think so. In other Real Madrid news, Jose's been given a 1-year suspended prison sentence, agreed to pay £1.9 million in fines after admitting tax fraud while he was manager there. Someone did tweet, what's the best 11 you could make of footballers who've committed tax fraud? It'd be bloody good, wouldn't it? I mean,
they'd all be Barcelona and Real Madrid players, so yeah,
absolutely.
It would.
Absolutely.
Why are they all, what is that? Is that just
because
bad lawyers?
because they've got people advising them and saying you should do this, and the guy signs on the dotted line. I'm not sure that the guys actually know what they're doing. Which is why, and it's a good way for the Spanish state to make some money a bit later on down the line, and sentence people to jail sentence which they will never serve.
Did anyone enjoy Jose falling over on an ice rink this week or not?
Oh, at the ice hockey game.
We've done it at Wembley. We've seen it.
Okay.
Been there, done that.
And ice is slippy, right?
Oh, it's just slippy. I mean, he has an excuse.
That is true, but is it not a concern for his next employer that he's sort of slipping up in such high-profile sort of situations?
Well, you see, that happened before he'd even started.
A little metaphor there.
Yeah, maybe.
Possibly. Borussia Dortmund, out of the Pokal, Andy.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely competition in which there are surprises.
Exactly, there are. I mean, you know, you can be on the back foot right by the start of the season, because what I always love about the Pokal is the fact that the first round is before the first round of league fixtures. So look at Eintracht Frankfurt this season. They got belted in the Super Cup by Bayern. Then they were the holders of the Pokal. And they went out of the cup to fourth division opposition before the league season started. I mean, now that is pressure with which to start a season. They've done brilliantly since, obviously not in the Pokal because they've not been in it. But now Borussia Dortmund, the leaders, are out. They went out at home on penalties to Werder Bremen, I know, a favourite of Philippe's.
Absolutely.
And great to see Claudio Pizarro score at 40 years old.
Stop
again.
It. Well done him, eh? And Michael Royce got injured. Is he out of the Spurs game?
Well, they're very cagey about it, Dortmund, at the moment. They said they might not play him against Hoffenheim at the weekend, which is obviously a big game for them. They're 7 points clear at the top, but you know, you can never feel safe when it's Bayern behind you. But with Royce, they have to be very careful, because you know, you look at his injury history, you look at the fact that I mean, I think you can say he was the best player in the Bundesliga in the calendar year of 2018, because the way he came in the second half of last season, saw them over the line to get into the Champions League in the first place. He's been the captain and best player this season. You know, I don't think it's any exaggeration to say if he missed the tie, it could be as big a loss to them as Harry Kane would be to Spurs, because the click that he has with the coach as well. And he's had this relationship with Lucien Favre since Favre gave him his head at Borussia Mönchengladbach in the first place. I think they're cautious, and he's cautious, and they're right to be, because there's still a feeling, even 7 points clear at the top, that if he's out, it could torpedo their season pretty quickly.
And you have a feeling as well, going back to that game in Frankfurt, that they had chances to actually win that game handsomely.
Yeah, they did.
And they didn't take it. And you're wondering, is it one of those when, okay, they've made 1 point over Bayern, but is it a bit like Liverpool got 1 point and didn't take full advantage of the possibility they had of taking more?
If they don't beat Hoffenheim at the weekend, it's an issue for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Producer Jonathan wondering if I said Marco Royce or the excellent Irish centre forward Mike O'Royce. in the Coupe de France, PSG only just threw Philippe.
Well, yeah, when you look at the scoreline, you would say, oh, 3-0, no problem. But in fact, it was really, really tough. They were playing against a team that is fighting to stay up in the Nationals, the third tier of French football, Villefranche, who were not playing in Villefranche, they were playing in Lyon. So that was second trip to that stadium in which PSG had come to a cropper, actually, against a wonderful OL team at the weekend. And it was really, really tough. And in fact, Tuchel, I think, looked really nervy. They had to call on the big guns, which they wanted to rest, like Cavani and Mbappe had to come on. And they only won in extra time. And Tuchel was sent off to the stands as well for some very aggressive behaviour towards the officials. And so it was not the kind of game that settled the nerves, which are already quite raw before the encounter with Manchester United.
Are they nervous about that game?
They're very, very nervous about it.
I always thought that. I mean, I covered them going out to Barcelona and I covered them going out to Real Madrid. And I've actually written about this week. And what I've seen from PSG is that when the stakes are that high, I mean, of course, against Villefranche, it's not that high, but of course, they're, you know, they've got the chance to exit a cup. So that obviously changes the parameters. But when the stakes are that high, they mentally just have this, there's a fragility there. For me, there's a mental fragility, and knowing that they've got that psychological blow of no Neymar for the two games, and I think he makes a huge difference.
And probably no Verratti, which means no midfield.
Yes.
Which was already an issue. And it's interesting, I thought, after the Villefranche game, the way that Tuchel talked about the fact that I shouldn't have to be playing players like Draxler and Di Maria. Just saying again, look what hand I've been dealt by Antero Henrique, the sporting director. I mean, we know that these sort of clashes, and anyone who's followed Dortmund knows that these sort of clashes are Tuchel all over. The difference is, in France, that people are going, yeah, fair enough, you're right. Which really compromises Enrique's position.
Restman, are you saying it's Paris Spurs-y-Germain?
Nice, I like how you did that.
Apparently puns were a thing on this pod once. I don't
once back in the day. Yeah. This is when you weren't around. No, I'm joking. No, I do think that when it comes to the crunch, they have a problem. And I think with Thomas Tuchel, it's interesting that he's, you know, there to be the man who's supposed to steer them forward on this European voyage that they're on, because he is prone to those nerves. He's prone to the tetchy clashes with the hierarchy as well that we saw at Dortmund before he left as well. So it's whether he can keep them together. And this is a side that they've not been dealt a good hand, particularly in Europe in the last few years, placing Barcelona and Real Madrid. Now they've got Manchester United. When they were Jose Mourinho's Manchester United, I think it was quite a decent prospect. Now it's this rejuvenated Manchester United.
I'm very much looking forward to Paul Pogba against Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
I think he might have a decent game.
I think he might be all right, don't you think?
In the FA Cup, the best game was Newport County 2, Middlesbrough 0. I mean, classic FA Cup tie, wasn't it? Dodgy pitch, terrible weather, a keeper with a wife in labour with twins.
a goal scorer who was stacking supermarket shelves for a couple of years back.
It's true, yeah. I mean, Robbie Wilmore, who actually was a youth team player at Cambridge and was a professional footballer for years and years, and then went and worked in supermarket and went back to professional football. And I was like, I'm sure he wasn't just wandering around a supermarket for years until suddenly said, do you want to kick a ball? Which is how it's sort of the story, how it's
maybe somebody
given.
Saw him doing kippy uppies with an orange or something like that.
I was going to say a cauliflower.
Yeah, maybe. Cauliflower.
So the keeper, Joe Day, he found out she'd gone into labour before the game, but he... And she gave birth, I think, during the game.
But he switched his phone off the game, so he wouldn't have any updates.
The nicest bit was, at the end of the game, he went up to the manager, Michael Flynn, said, is it all right if I go now? You know, just in case. She certainly had a busier night than he did, because, I mean, you know, Middlesbrough were terrible in that game.
No, they didn't want it. And Newport want it. Newport love this competition. Yeah. I've covered them a few times now in this competition. I wasn't at that particular game, but I was there for the game against Leicester.
Yeah.
The ground, the way that... I mean, this is a supporter-owned club. This is a club that went into liquidation, that the fans bought back. This is a club with real ambition to do well in this competition. They've caused the upsets. They rise to the occasion. And I think it's a fantastic, fantastic,
it's
classic
going to be a
FA Cup
against,
story.
Against City, isn't it?
I would love to
What's
see
the
what
date
they could
of
produce.
The
16th of February.
16th
Saturday
of February,
the 16th.
Okay, in the diary.
Oh, right.
And that's your diary, is it?
Any other commitments you need us to tell you about that you can just add in for now?
But I have to say, Rodney Parade is one of those grounds where, I mean, when I started doing Champions League with BT Sport, I was, you know, off at the Bernabeu and off at the Camp Nou and, you know, all these glamorous locations. And then I got sent to Rodney Parade for an FA Cup game. And the pitch was a lot worse than it is now. And that was the first time I realised I need different footwear when I come to a non-league ground.
Do you know what?
And I actually went out and made a purchase of boots that I didn't mind if they got muddy or dirty, because that's what was necessary for the job.
I interviewed Mike Flynn yesterday, and he said, yeah. I said, what are you going to do with that pitch? He went, well, look, we'll organise a seven-a-side rugby tournament on it. We'll get all the kids to run up and down it before the game. They played some decent stuff.
He's great, though, isn't he?
He's really good value.
I mean, the fans adore him. He is the local lad who's, you know, come good in this role. And I think
the second goal is absolutely magnificent.
Yeah, it's sort of it was a Sheringham.
Yes.
Anderton Sheringham corner, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he took it beautifully. It's very hard to strike a ball.
Well, the other thing is there's a special bonus, isn't there, this year for the team in each EFL division who gets the furthest. So they get an extra £250,000. So for Newport and for potentially, I guess it's Wimbledon and Doncaster in
QPR?
The third tier, that's something that's massive.
Right. So explain that to me again.
Like the team that goes the furthest of any team in their division from each EFL division gets a bonus of £250,000, which for a third or fourth tier club is, you know, pretty big.
Brilliant.
And let's not forget, it's kind of an audition for all these players, and for Mike Flynn himself, really, for for maybe bigger things ahead.
Possibly. Wolves are through. Just squeezed past Shrewsbury. They go to Bristol City. QPR beat Portsmouth. They'll be home to Watford in the next round. Brentford got past Barnet. They go to Swansea. And Brighton beat West Brom after extra time. Glenn Murray scoring twice in extra time. One which sort of went in off his undercrackers. But, you know, they all count, don't they? And Peter, thank you to Peter, said, I'm watching West Brom v Brighton, and now thanks to Max, I can't stop looking at Paul Tierney's arms. They're honestly incredibly hairy. Thank you, Peter. It makes me feel like it's worthwhile making these observations.
Is it one of those ones that when he's pictured in the programme, you can't tell if he's got tattoo sleeves or whether it's body hair?
No, it's you know, it's gorillery. It's not a tattoo you'd have.
Is it Ryan Giggs's chest?
It's, you know, the hairiest man I know in football is Richard Keys. So... I don't know Ryan Giggs's chest that well. Oh, yes,
no,
obviously
you do. Must have seen Ryan Giggs's chest.
That's true. Yeah. No, I suppose so. Yeah, it's like that, I'd say.
Yeah.
His arms
are like that.
I haven't seen Paul Tierney's chest, though.
That's bear-like.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it is bear-like. Scotland now, a full fixture list in Scotland last night. Celtic won their fifth game in a row to maintain their six-point advantage over Rangers. Stevie G's side went to third place. Aberdeen beat them 4-2. Alfredo Morelos was sent off for a stamp, his fourth red card of the season. Of those four, it's the third time he's been sent off playing against Aberdeen. It's an incredible record. He's the top scorer in the league. He's also top of the disciplinary charts, 9 yellows and 3 reds. James says, after Morelos' surprise red card against Aberdeen, surely Rangers should face some action. So many red cards this season. How much would Gerrard be to blame for this?
I mean, does Morelos get some sort of reduction? Because it's only really half a red card, isn't it? Because he got the other guy sent off at the same time as well. I guess that's how you'd think of it from a Rangers perspective.
It's in his contract. If I get a red but the other lad gets a red, it's all right.
Yeah, I only get fined half a week's wages.
And the question is, the cliche question I like to ask is, if you took that out of his game, like getting sent off every other game, would he be the same player? I mean, be on the pitch a bit more.
No, he wouldn't be the same player. He would play more often.
Yeah. So surely it'd be a good thing. David says, are you going to get off the Steven Gerrard bandwagon? Now his team are indeed 6 points behind the most mediocre Celtic team of the past 5 years. Well, I don't know if I am on the Stevie G bandwagon. I don't know if this pod is on the Stevie G bandwagon.
Not really, no.
Everyone's just enjoying the fact that the Scottish Premiership was a bit more competitive than what we'd seen in recent
seasons.
Sounds
like you're on the bandwagon to me.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I mean, it was Celtic have a bit of a lead now, but you know, when it was tight or tighter, and it still could go to one of those other sides, you know, you want Kilmarnock to win it or something, don't you? To make it
absolutely
different.
But it's good to have Rangers back as well in this. You know,
you're definitely on the Rangers bandwagon.
The other end of the table, Hamilton Accies picked up their first win in 10 at home to St Johnstone. Now, before we end part two, we should pay tribute to Vicky Orvice, one of the founders of the organisation Women in Football, an excellent journalist. She passed away at the age of 56, sadly. And Reshmin and Philippe, you both knew her.
Yes, quite well. And Vicky, I think, was universally loved in our profession. So we've lost a really very, very dear friend who was also a very important trailblazer, the first woman to join the National Committee of the Football Writers Association. And she was actually the joint chair of this organization, and we were in charge of the book committee, Vicky and I. So she's been, I mean, I don't know what to say. And we're all in shock. And she was one of the bravest people I've ever met in my life and one of the most dignified and graceful people I've ever met in my life. But she was a fantastic journalist, I think a genuine inspiration for many. And somebody, again, I should say a trailblazer, when she, not just in football, even though I think she was the first woman reporter to get a job on a tabloid, but also in athletics. And there have been a number of tributes, including by Paula Radcliffe, and who basically explain how important she was and how loved and respected she was. And so, yeah, it's been a very, very tough day for a number of people, and special thoughts for her husband, Ian Ridley. They were incredibly close, those two. And so our heart really goes out to Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I knew Vicky less well. I mean, I met Vicky a few times on the circuit and various sort of women in football events and things like that. And she was, I think we sat on a chair on a panel once as well together talking about, you know, careers. Obviously, she was, you know, way ahead than me. But I think as a female, and we talked about banter, didn't we, in this pod as well. But, you know, when you think of the things she had to endure at the time that she was in this industry, it's things that would never be acceptable now. But it's just testament to how strong she was, what a trailblazer, as you say, Philippe, that she was, and an inspiration to every female sports journalist, without a shadow of a doubt. And more so, not just because of what she achieved, but she was such a lovely person. When in my, you know, few encounters with her, she's been nothing but encouraging and kind, funny. And I know a lot of people who knew her, you know, as well as you do, Philippe, and everyone was devastated. And of course, as you say, wish the, you know, her loved ones very well.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start with this Save Hakim campaign. You've heard us talk about it on the last couple of pods. Hakim Al-Araibi from Bahrain, granted political asylum in Australia, was detained in Thailand when he went over there for his honeymoon. We can talk to Craig Foster, former Australian international, played for Portsmouth and Palace over here, of course, who's been a big part of the campaign to get him released. Craig, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Give us a brief explanation of your role within this campaign.
Oh, gee, I'm just one of many. You know, there's many human rights organisations in Australia. Australian government's completely on board now. We've got the ambassador designate and the whole post staff over in Bangkok. We've got the Centre for Sport and Human Rights. We've got World Players United. We've got FIFPro. And we're trying to get FIFA to take further action as well. So I'm just one of a number of former players here in Australia who feel we've got an obligation to help Hakim and stand up for him. He's a player in the second division here who several months ago we weren't aware of until it came to our attention, you know, the political web that he's been caught in, the injustice that is underway here. And we naturally knew that it's his colleagues in football and ex-players who are going to have to fight for him.
And that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That actually, because of how important football is in Thailand, that football can make a difference here, can cut through a little bit.
That's right. And it's starting to. And after a couple of months, we're really delighted that we've seen some of the high-profile players out of England and Italy, Giorgio Chiellini, you know, Didier Drogba, ex-Chelsea, of course, Ivory Coast. Gary Lineker was very important. You know, for him to bring his voice to bear. Robbie Fowler was one of the early ones, and we can't thank him enough because, you know, you need the early starters, if you like, and, you know, encourages others to get on board. And Jamie Vardy was important because, of course, it's a Thai-owned club, Leicester. So that really got great cut through. And to get the message out allows us to speak to the Thai football fans. That's been really important.
And you've just been in Thailand. You saw him briefly. How did he seem?
Well, horrible. The visiting sections are about 15 minutes each. You know, you go in there. There's only a small list now because in the past 4 or 5 days, after a number of journalists went in, the Thai government cracked down in the remand prison there and have a small list of people who are close friends or others. You have 15 minutes to sit down. You know, you pick up the phone through the perspex, just like you tend to see on the move. It's very confronting. He's been there over almost 80 days now. So his condition is deteriorating, both physically, he's very thin now, and also emotionally. He's very worried about his wife, and he's not quite sure how long this might drag on. We know it could, if he's in the court system. In the past, it has dragged on anywhere up to 4 years. So we're adamant that every day is important, that we don't want anyone resting on their laurels and thinking that a 60-day preparation period for his lawyers is anywhere near acceptable. We just want Thailand to release him under their obligations under international law. At the moment, we are calling on the Thai Prime Minister to use his executive discretion. He continues, whilst that's been confirmed that he does have that under the Extradition Act of Thailand, and the prosecutor in court last Monday confirmed that to us. I asked her specifically in court, and she said, yes, he can. The Thai government and Prime Minister are continued to deny that he has the ability to simply step in and abide by international law and let him go. He does. So we want people to continue to put pressure on General Prayut and the Thai government. But also we're calling for sporting sanctions from FIFA, and that's really important. I'll give you an example. So under the human rights policy of FIFA, every football official has an obligation to not just protect but promote the human rights. That means they have to step forward and actively assist Hakim in the present case. FIFA, we've encouraged them strongly to do something. And then you've got the Bahrain and Thai FAs who have been completely silent. well, you know, FIFA have been saying to us, well, you know, we think that the president of the Thai FA is on board and trying to help. But just today on their website, there's been a couple of clubs, Chiang Rai and others in Thailand, who've used Save Hakim hashtag and taken some photos. And just today they've put on their website a communique to say this is political, this is against the regulations, which is absolutely inaccurate. It's disgraceful. So we want FIFA to sanction the country. We want international and Champions League club games not to be played there in the immediate term until such time as Thailand and Bahrain can guarantee the safety of refugee players travelling through there.
Craig, thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Craig Foster there. Gianni Infantino looks like he'll get a second term as FIFA president. He's the only candidate entered into June's election.
Like he might. Yeah.
Well, former Spurs defender Ramon Vega said he would stand against him. Didn't get enough support.
Yeah, everybody knew he was not going to. It was not the first time that Vega had threatened, but everybody knew since the way that nominations were changed is that you've got to have letters of support from various FAs. You've got to show that you were involved in the running of football administration. And obviously, we knew that Ramon Vega would fail. It's interestingly, it's a regulation which was introduced after our colleague Grant Wall, you might remember, wanted to be a candidate for the FIFA presidency, and people didn't like that. So said, "Well, he can at the moment. No, he shouldn't be able to. So we'll make sure it stays with the boys." So Jenny is going to be triumphantly re-elected president on the 5th of June. By the 211 football associations without an opponent, just like Blatter in 2011 and just like Platini, I think, almost every single term, those great Democrats and advocates of transparency.
He can plan his thank you speech from now.
It should be really good, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
I would like it if football was run by just, you know, okay Spurs centre-backs, you know, from the 80s and 90s. Vega, Nethercott, Kevin Scott, you know. I mean,
stop trying to bring Culverhouse into this. Come on.
All right. I'd allow Mabbott, and which wouldn't be
a promotion.
Yeah. But Mabbott was too good. So, you know. Anyway, look, there is some football happening this weekend. Let's get back to it. Look ahead to the games in the Premier League. Fulham play Man United. Mike says, good morning, everybody. Fulham spent over £100 million on transfers this season. Still have one of the worst Premier League defences ever. The January window effort was pathetic. Two wingers and a defender in, so relegation looks certain. Has a Premier League team ever spent more than Fulham and also been relegated? It's a very good question.
Well, it's not that good a question because the TV deal's gone up so much in the last
couple of years. OK, it's a terrible question, Mike.
Sorry.
So it's no, isn't it?
Yeah, it's no.
But do we think... Because they've spent more money than a lot of sides that are in the Premier League. Obviously, they had a lot of players. They didn't have that big a squad after the summer, right? It wasn't like they could have kept the squad that had got them into the Premier League.
The last team I can think that had this level of turnover after being promoted, Blackpool under Ian Holloway, maybe. Really? You know where you get 15 in and 15 out. It's like being in charge of a Isthmian League team or something, isn't it?
I think you probably have more continuity in the Isthmian League, to be honest. Palace play West Ham. No idea which West Ham will turn up. Francis says, do you think Crystal Palace are being weighed down by Roy Hodgson? I think their squad is good enough to compete for the Everton Cup.
The Everton Cup?
Yes, that's finishing seventh.
Ah, sorry. I had missed that one.
That's okay.
To be honest...
Thought you were a regular listener, Philippe. It's very upsetting.
Well, yeah, they're quite a long way away, aren't they? My goodness, they are. Heaven's above.
I think Roy's done okay, hasn't he?
Yeah, I'm not taking this. And I'd get in trouble at home as well because one of my son's friends, who's seven, approached me the other day and he went, looking all shifty, you work about something about football, don't you? And I said, yeah. He said, you know, the best coach in the world is. And I was expecting, you know, Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp. And he said, that old man that manages Crystal Palace.
How old is this kid?
Seven.
Seven?
Yeah.
Huddersfield Arsenal, according to David Ornstein from the BBC, there were no funds available for Arsenal to even bring Callum Chambers back from on loan. They were trying to get Chambers back.
That
he
is
plays in
genuinely
midfield
insane.
Now anyway, doesn't he?
I mean,
he plays in midfield, yes.
That sounds insane on so many levels.
And apparently,
I know that they've dropped in the rich list. They're only the ninth richest club on the planet. And they can't get anybody on loan apart from Denis Suarez, really?
Denver Nuggets having a great season, though.
Only got £45 million to spend in the summer, apparently. I saw Manuel Petit saying, you know, what's the point of getting rid of Wenger and then telling the new manager he hasn't got any money to spend either? Mm. And they've got the Ozil situation and the fact that Aaron Ramsey gets better with every game. I mean, it's...
Yes.
Is it a disaster or...
No, I wouldn't call that a disaster. I think they're more or less where we expect them to be, and in fact, perhaps a little bit ahead of what we expected them to be. I think it's all been a little bit too much. Emery is a genius when there was this sequence of 22 games without a defeat and Emery out, which we've heard a few times. But Huddersfield shouldn't pose a huge problem. I mean, it looks to me that, and actually quite... I think reasonably, they're already preparing for life in the championship, and they're planning, which is, I think, absolutely right for relegation. And this is how we're going to bounce back, like Burnley did when they went down with Sean Dyche and decided, yeah, we're not going to panic about it. And you know, Huddersfield are basically, I would say, they're on holidays, but what is there for them to play?
Liverpool, Bournemouth. Producer Jonathan says, will there be a Dominic Solanke winner for Bournemouth in this game? I mean, Liverpool absolutely, you know, desperate for the win, aren't they? Sort of game you want. Bournemouth at home? No?
I don't know. I mean, Bournemouth of late have shown some rather lovely things, haven't they?
They're unpredictable,
yeah,
aren't
they? Yeah, they're unpredictable. A bit like West Ham, aren't they? A bit. You don't know which one's going to turn up, but it should be a good game for Liverpool. You'd hope that they could not bounce back.
You've got to expect goals there, haven't
you've
you?
You've got to expect goals, that they'll get some confidence back.
Southampton, Cardiff. Now, this is a... The Emiliano Sala story is obviously it's a tragedy, and we should always remember that's, you know, two people have lost their lives here. But this story that Nantes have asked Cardiff for the first instalment of the transfer fee, they received a letter from Nantes on Tuesday, apparently, in which the French club threatened to take legal action if the first scheduled payment is not received within the next 10 days. They are entitled to the first slice of Sala's reported 15 million fee by now. Cardiff seem to be very surprised by that, and the timing just seems absolutely terrible.
Yeah, it is shocking. Is it surprising? Perhaps not, as this situation was something that people within the microcosm were already talking about. I would say on the day we learned of the disappearance of Le Plain thing, nothing like this has ever happened. It is so complicated legally. Whose insurance is going to work? We don't know. It all depends on the circumstances of the tragedy. Was there negligence on the part of one of the other clubs, of the agent, who is responsible? So therefore, which insurance policy is going to kick in and all these sort of things? And obviously, these are questions which must be addressed at some point. Mm-hmm. The way in which they're being addressed is simply sordid. And when you think you've got families grieving as they are now, and that these people just keep quiet, guys, basically, and let your lawyers do the talking in the background, because you have to do it. It's true, it has to be done, but
we don't have to see it.
No.
And I think,
and this is so shocking. You think about Salah's family and Mr. Robertson's family as well, and you think this is just uncalled for, isn't it, at this time, really awful. And I have to say that, am I surprised that Valdemar Kita would do something like that? No, I'm not. I'm not. There is another actor in this, which is Bordeaux. We were talking with Andy about it beforehand, because Bordeaux are due to be paid, or were due to be paid, half of the difference between the fee they got from Nantes when they sold the player and the fee that had been agreed between Nantes and Cardiff. And we're talking about 8 million euros here, so a huge sum for a club like Bordeaux. And they have made moves, and they realized, oops, maybe it's not the right time to do this. So they're in the background now. And you wish that everybody would have had the same common sense and decency to do such a thing. Unfortunately, that's not the case.
I just wonder how you feel if you're Nico Palois, who was his best friend, who's Salah's best friend at Nantes. And he got an amazing reception off the fans, actually, at the Beaujoire when they played on Tuesday night. And he was quite clearly emotional by it. And then you find out a day later that your president's doing this. I mean, it's, as well as being quite a despicable way to handle things anyway, and it's something that's I think going to adversely affect what must be an already quite a fragile dressing room.
You're right, these things have to be addressed. You just wonder why, and obviously we don't know how desperate Nantes are for financially, but you wonder why they didn't just say, look, we know we've got to sort this out, but let's just wait 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever, until this is all you know, given some people some time.
Incidentally, obviously this was an utter tragedy and it's not something you can ever factor in, but is it something that is in a contract negotiation? You know, or is it part of the contract at any point? If something happens to the player, this is what happens next.
I unfortunately had to write a big piece of France Football on the subject, and I had to delve in this particular subject. And I'm not sure I want to do it anymore. But you're absolutely right, because we don't know exactly what the situation is, because sometimes the players are insured as a group, and when they change their registration, they become part of another policy, provided that the person who is a subscriber policy has said, well, there is another name to be added to the list. We don't know if Cardiff has done it, for example. But it also depends if there's been an act of gross negligence. And the more we learn about the circumstances of the tragedy, the more we are left completely, aghast by the succession of really awful choices which have been made by a number of people, starting with the people who claimed to be or who represented him in those in these negotiations. And I know that I think Cardiff, in a way, has handled that with a little bit more decency, and that they've said, you know, we don't want to talk too much about it. We will compensate, obviously, but we want to know exactly what happened and establish the circumstances and find out who the people who are responsible, if there are any responsibilities, and to establish it beyond doubt. For goodness, that's just common sense, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just very, very basic decency.
Yeah, completely agree. Other Premier League fixtures, Watford play Everton, so presumably Watford won't really want to do Marco Silva a favour. Brighton, Burnley on Sunday. Spurs, Leicester and Man City, Chelsea. Dwayne says, who does Mike Dean send off on Sunday in the City-Chelsea game to reach his century in style? That's a great question. I mean, David Luiz would be a fun one.
I was going to say David Luiz.
You think Luiz?
That was my one.
Who else could he go for?
Connoisseur's choice, Fernandinho.
That's not bad. Second yellow card.
Yeah. Second yellow for Fernandinho.
Yeah.
I mean, really, if
at the 73rd minute.
You're going 73rd minute. I reckon it might be an early one. I think Luiz early.
I think Luiz is the one, isn't he? He'll find a way.
I don't think you want to go too early. I mean, you know, if it was your testimonial and you're taking a penalty, you don't score it in the first minute, do you?
Unless he plays so much injury time, there are 100 minutes. So he can send someone off in the 100th minute. And then Mike Dean will get a standing ovation, a minute's applause for Mike Dean's 100th red card. Why not? Do we see Spurs beating Leicester? They've had three scratchy wins, late wins in a row.
Scratchy, but they actually played decent football, and then they had created loads of chances. And the fact that they're missing their number one and number two goal scorers, number one goal scorer at the moment, has made it look perhaps more difficult than it was. But when you've got, they really have got the bit between their teeth. It's quite remarkable how this this team.
And I think they'll have it more this year with the title race being a little bit open. Sorry, I just completely interrupted you.
No, it's okay, Richard. I was going to say, but every time we get to this stage, we go,
and what if Tottenham?
And then they lose at home to Wolves, or they lose a game like this. We shall see. Finally, most importantly, Liam says, which TV detective would you love to see play a full 38-game season for Manchester City? Columbo playing in a deep-lying playmaker role? Luther as a ball-playing centre-back? David Tennant's Broadchurch character as a marauding wing-back? What do you think? I mean, I would play
Cumberbatch as the number 10, the scheming number 10.
Luther. Do you think you would go Luther, would you?
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, I hate to use a celeb anecdote. I did play football with Idris Elba once.
No,
really?
Clang.
He's useless.
Is he?
Yeah, really not very good.
But he did the boxing thing, didn't he? He was
fit,
more.
But actually, it was a sort of classic Harry Redknapp. Harry Redknapp was the manager of this team. and he came into the dressing room. And he was like, and obviously Idris Elba was like clearly the most famous person there, and they just got enough people to make up the numbers. And Harry Redknapp came up to me, and I think it was Dan Walker, and he was like, who's this Idris Elba then? Who is that? And we were like, it's in The Wire. Have you seen The Wire? It's brilliant. He was like, I've seen The Wire. He's like, and he's in Luther. Have you seen Luther? Luther? What's Luther? Anyway, so we had this chat, and then 5 minutes later, Idris Elba walked in, and Harry went straight up to him and went, Idris, I loved you in Luther, mate. You were superb. Like, it's man management, isn't it?
That is.
Put your arm around him. Absolute
Harry.
Classic. Anyway, look, thanks very much for your time today, Reshmin.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.